That is channel two over. This is channel two over, and it has to be redone too. That echo is in it from looking one way and looking away from the microphone. This is channel two over. This is channel two over, and it has to be done all over again. This is channel two over. And this is Thursday night, 23rd of October, 69, after supper, and the lights are back on.
No, Barbara, I don't remember reading about any of that in Belgium in our papers.
Well, it was on the BBC News in England a lot. Things about Arabs bombing Israeli airlines. I never realized quite that they would carry it, you know, that far. You know, you expect terrorist activities in Israel, but in Belgium and, well, even in England, they have peace marches because, you know, there are a lot of Arabs and so forth in England. A lot of immigrants. They get Arab immigrants, and thanks to the policy in 1952, they're being flooded by Indian and Pakistani immigrants.
Oh, they are still?
Oh, yeah.
I didn't realize that.
It's quite a problem, really. Because the Pakistanis tend to take over all the real estate business, and housing. The English don't like. And they're sometimes can be right fiery people, too. They get upset about something. I never had much to do with any of the Pakistani immigrants, really. There was one person who I think was half Pakistani. I'm not really sure about that, but I think he was half Pakistani. Trudy was the one who said that, because she said from his temperament and everything, he must be. and his coloring, of course. Mm-hmm. Coloring and facial features. But he was a character. His name was Mr. Taliki. And he bought a horse for his daughter. He bought one of the horses that was used a lot in the school. It didn't belong to the tilts, but the owners didn't ride it much. So it was almost exclusively used as a school horse. And he bought it when the owners decided to sell. He bought it for his daughter and continued to keep it at the tilts. And but as soon as he bought it, he made sort of reservations about the horse. For one thing, it could not be taken out on hacks. It could not, unless it was ridden by Judy or C, a tilk. And if Amanda was there, it was not to be used in lessons. And she was not to ride the horse on hacks. She could only ride it in the school or in the fields immediately surrounding the tilks. And, of course, it didn't work very well because this horse was used so much. And the main problem was it was Amanda, who was she was easily talked into doing something. And she was very generous by nature. And if she was there, for instance, on a Saturday and we needed the horse for a lesson, she'd say, go ahead and use it. Then she'd go home and tell her father, I could only ride Jesse so much today because the horse was used in a lesson. And that would send her father, you know, make him furious. And this happened several times. And he phoned and gave strict instructions that the horse was not to be used when Amanda was on weekends, because Amanda came on weekends. And then Amanda went on holiday for 2 weeks, so we used the horse on weekends because we knew she wasn't coming. Well, then she, something happened. Oh, she was supposed to come out one weekend, and she didn't come at the usual time. She usually came in the morning, and she didn't get there. And we needed the horse, so Judy said, well, she's not coming. We'll use the horse in lesson. And just as the horse was going into the lesson, Talik has arrived. And he saw this horse going in. And he had Judy out in the middle of the yard and was giving her a dressing down. And Siegel went out as head girl. Took over. And said that the arrangement was that if Amanda was not there, the horse could be used. And he said, well, I've given instructions that the horse is not to be used on weekends. And see, he says, very well, then, what are we to do? When you say the horse is not to be used, and your daughter comes and says, use the horse, I can't ride it enough myself. He says, you're to obey me, I'm the adult, she's only a child. And this was out in the middle of the yard, and he would get so furious, he would turn red, his whole face would turn red, and he would practically shake and quiver, and he'd gave C this dressing down in the middle of the yard with all the clients around. And they were all thinking, poor C. But about 2 weeks after that, I took a phone call from him, and he said, neither Judy or C was there. And I answered the phone, and he asked if he could speak to them. I said, no, I'm sorry. They're out. I knew Judy was up at the house, but I wasn't going to tell him that. And he said, well, tell Judy that I'm taking Jesse away Saturday. I said, oh, yes, all right. Anything else? And he said, no, just tell her I'm going to pick up my horse on Saturday. So then he apparently called back later and spoke to Judy again and explained that they had found a place where they could keep the horse out in the field and Amanda could go and ride it 2 or 3 times a week. And it was closer to their home, and it was he was not quite so brusque then as he was with me. And he gave all these nice, reasonable explanations. So after we got this news, and after Jesse was packed away on the trailer, we all went and sort of had a quiet giggle to ourselves, because we knew that Jesse could not be caught if she decided she didn't want to be caught. And Amanda was the least person likely in the world to be able to catch her if she decided she didn't want to get caught. And here she was going to be turned out in a field and not ridden enough. She was used to being worked 2 or 3 hours a day. And here she would probably be worked 3 times a week. We could just see it. And she carted Amanda around enough as it was with all the work she was having. Amanda would never be able to handle her just without it. And sure enough, about 3 weeks later, Mr. Talicki called. Judy was prepared. And he said, we can't catch Jess. Oh, really?
Revenge,
yes it was. We want to know if we can bring her back. Well, I'm sorry, Mr. Talicki, but we're already using all our stall space. We don't have room for her. Well, can I bring her back in the fall? Well, yes, but we can only take horses in the fall on the condition that we can use them. Without reservation. So Jessie's coming back in the fall on the condition that she can be used in the school. But in the meantime, Mr. Talicki's going to have to put up with a child that can't ride her own horse.
Barbara, we never saw that in the newspapers about the Arabs giving so much trouble over in Belgium.
Well, we had a lot of it on on British news, you know, about the bombing of Israeli airlines. These young terrorists would wander through an airport and throw a bomb into the Israeli airline ticket office or something like that, or the planes.
In Belgium.
And
all those those Arabs are so peppery. I never saw one close up. I saw a few. The Indians can too. I never saw any Indians close up.
Well, you know, there are a lot of Pakistani in England now. Matter of fact, we had one man that was part Pakistani. I think he was half Pakistani. Kept a horse out at Tilks.
And he's peppery?
Oh, yeah. He's peppery.
Go ahead.
All right. Well, Mr. Taliki was, he was a problem client. He could, it was bad enough when his daughter was just riding out there, and he'd come out and jump up and down about how she was being taught. But then he decided to buy one of the horses for her. And, anyway, he started off bad enough. He had all these nice little reservations about what could be done with the horse. It could only go on hacks. If it was ridden by Judy or C, a tilt. And it's like saying a cheap violin can only be played by some master. But then he said that Amanda couldn't ride the horse except around on the tilt property. She couldn't take the horse on a hack either. And the horse couldn't be used for... It could be used for lessons during the week. I mean, that was great. Saved him money. But it couldn't be used if Amanda was there. And that ran into problems right away, because Amanda would come, and she would say, oh, if you need Jess, use her. By all means, use her. And then she would go home, and don't think she realized the effect it had on her father. I'm not sure. He probably pumped her by how much she rode Jess.
Oh, yeah.
Because he would. You know, he was the type to do that.
To check on you.
To check on us, yeah. He would, at any rate, she would go home, and she would say, well, I rode Jess so much today, and I couldn't ride her more because she was used in such a, you know, she was used in a lesson. And Mr. Taliki's blood pressure would go up a bit. And he'd get about so much of that, and then he'd come charging out. And he caught, came out one day, and the horse was just coming out of a lesson. I think that was it. And he was furious. He caught Judy, and Judy managed to get away with Celia came out. And he stood in the middle of the yard dressing Celia down because the horse was being used. And he was a great big man.
Oh, was he?
Yeah, he was a big man with a florid face, and it would get redder and redder the more the angrier he got, and the more he talked the angrier he got.
Yeah.
And he started on Celia about using the horse when on weekends. He had given strict instructions that the horse was not to be used on weekends. And Celia says, well, Mr. Taliki, I really don't know who to believe, because you tell us that you've said the horse can't be used on weekends, but Amanda says go ahead and use the horse. Now, who am I to believe? And he bellowed out that he was the adult. She was only a child, and you should believe the adult. And Celia managed fairly well and got herself out of it. I don't know how. and all the clients were sympathizing with her. I do know that.
No.
Because, you know, they rather felt for her. But about two weeks...
They weren't enjoying it?
Well, they may have been enjoying it from the side, but they felt for her because
yeah.
of...
Because he must have been
a difficult
really
man.
Difficult, yeah.
You're
yeah.
working her over.
Yeah.
In public.
Yeah, he didn't bother. And it was he was like this all the time. He'd come in with these beefs he had about one thing or another. And he'd just lay into you. And even the tone he took with me a week later, I answered the phone. And he asked if he could speak to Judy or Celia. And, he would, all the time he would call every week. He always had something. He would call nearly, for a while he was calling every day about one thing or another.
Why?
I'm not joking. Every noontime, when we were up at lunch, he would call and insist on speaking to Judy about one thing or another. This was during the period when he was buying the horse. And he'd have to know this, and he'd have to know that. And anyway, I took a phone call from him about a week after this incident in the yard. And he insisted on speaking to Judy, and I knew where Judy was, but I wasn't going to go find her because I knew that most of the time he didn't have anything to say.
Mm-hmm.
He was just beefing. So I said I couldn't find her. I said she was out, she's gone. And he said, "You tell Judy that I am going to take my horse away on Saturday." Oh, you know. "Yes, sir. Is there anything else?" He says, "No. Just tell her I'm going to pick the horse up on Saturday morning. Taking it away." So they picked the horse up on Saturday morning. And Judy said, "Good riddance." And we all got in a little conclave to start talking about it, and we had a nice little giggle because we knew what was going to happen. Judy put it in exact words. She even had it down to the day that he was going to call back, because Jesse's hard to catch, and Jesse needs 2 or 3 hours a day of work to make her even manageable for Amanda to ride, for his daughter to ride. She couldn't have handled that horse if it didn't have 2 or 3 hours work a day.
My goodness.
Not that it didn't was mean. It was just simply, it was a strong-willed animal. It would just do what it wanted to. If it wanted to come back to the barn, it would have. And Amanda was weak, was very weak. She had no strength of character. None of this willpower that can make a horse do what you want it to. She couldn't even catch Jess. I mean, even when Jess was in the mood and anybody could walk up to Jess, Amanda had trouble. So we could see what was going to happen. And sure enough, about 3 weeks later, exactly when Judy had predicted it, Mr. Talicki phoned up, asked to speak to Judy, and asked in rather humbled tone if he could bring the horse back, that Amanda couldn't catch it. And Judy said, "No, we can't take the horse at the moment. We don't have room for it. The place has been taken by others." And so he asked if he could bring the horse back in the fall, because apparently they had this place where they had taken it, they were supposed to be able to get a box come winter, but they couldn't. So they didn't have any place to keep the horse in the winter. And Judy said, "Well, the only way we'll have room for that horse in the fall is if it comes under the condition that we can use it whenever we need it." And he had to say yes. He was caught. He was caught. That was that.
Well, I can see why the Israeli airplanes get bombed.
Well, now that's a retelling. Oh, the first one wasn't a little bit low-key, and she picked up the second one right well. This is 220 Channel 2 over, 220 Channel 2 over, and this is about 8 o'clock. Oh, it's later than that. The electricity went off. It's about bedtime on Thursday night, 23rd of October, 69.
Major Pilkington kept a couple horses at the place where I worked. He used to keep, I don't know, I think he kept three or four there at one time when he was hunting a lot. And he had the house still over. Where was their house?
It was the other side of the mall.
Yeah. Well, he had that place, and he would he stopped keeping horses there. He used to keep a lot there, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And he stopped keeping them there and started keeping and couldn't really go out if the weather was at all bad. So he would phone up and say he was going to go, and he'd get the horse ready, and then he'd decide it was too wet or too cold.
Well, I think you can have some bad weather down the morning, especially in the morning. Now, you see, I have a lot of this morning mist, fog, you know, and that was damp. And it's like you get in this country, the morning mist, which we, of course, we used to call the fried the morning. But it would be damp. But it was good, healthy country, though, really.
Mm-hmm.
One reason that we went there was my boy, he suffered as a youngster from septic tonsils. And we never could get him well enough to have them out. He'd go about 2 months and down he'd go again with them, you know. The doctor told us that we'd have to find somewhere different. We were living around Manchester at the time, which of course is very damp. And he said, you'll have to go leave here, he said, and find some other place, he said, to get him set up, you see. So we went down in June to Morton the Mark. And the following May, we got his tonsils out. And from then on, he'd come on my house on fire. But before that, he was a weakling, and he'd go to bed at night, and he'd come up with temperature, and there's a lot of worry with him.
Sure. Yeah.
He had him out at Cheltenham. Did you ever go to there?
Tell him how he looked.
Yeah, what about
me?
Okay. Yeah.
Well, he wore the socks and walking shoes.
Oh, plus fours.
Yeah, that's
plus
it.
Plus four. I've been trying to think of.
Yeah. And either a tweed jacket or a hunting jacket.
Oh, there'd be more tweed jackets.
Yeah.
Wore around.
And that wasn't what was so remarkable, though. Very few people who wear plus fours now, but he sort of looked like something out of a print. He was tall and thin and had a sort of a hook nose and a rather quick way of moving.
Uh-huh.
He moved very, very fast.
Well, his father wasn't a tall man. His father was not.
Well, come to think, he wasn't really all that tall.
He was not taller than me, his father. Well, he might have been 5'7", because I was 5'7".
Maybe he just seemed taller than me. I don't suppose he really was.
Oh, I don't know. He looked pretty tall, right? Yeah.
Well, anybody that's as tall as I am seems tall to me.
Yeah. But both his mother and father were
small.
All people.
Yeah. Well, I come to think of it, he wasn't all that tall. It was just that he gave an impression. He moved a bit.
Kids
fast.
Are bigger than the parents these days. I mean, my boy's 6 foot and my wife's 5'2".
Oh, really?
But you're talking about the tweed jackets and that. I remember the first time I met Lord Ashton, And he was worth, bags of money, you know what I mean? Billionaire, owned a city and all this kind of thing. In fact, Ashton is a sort of a suburb of Manchester, and he practically owned the whole lot of it, the factories and everything else. And I was shoeing his horses one day, his plough horses, this was. And even in those days, although tractors was well advanced, a lot of the farmers around there, the gentleman farmers, they preferred horses around the place and wouldn't have a tractor.
Well, no, I can't quite get your voice.
Like I was saying, that even in those days,
yeah,
the wealthy farmers would prefer horses to tractors,
uh-huh,
although tractors was quite popular.
Yeah.
So I'm shoeing Lord Ashton's horses one day on the green, and he owned this village, and he had his stables on one side and the shop and the barn and everything on the other side. So there was one guy holding for me, so almost another guy came down, just as badly dressed as he was, patched jacket and patched knees.
Uh-oh.
And he said to this guy, he said, "Oh, John," he said, "you go back to the barn," he said, "and I'll hold the horses for the blacksmith." I said, "Okay." So we're shoeing these horses, and one damn big thing he come out with, about 18 hands, weigh about 22 underweight, feet back. So I said to him, "I'm shearing this thing, you know," and I said to him, I said, "you know," I said, "the guy that bought this ought to drop dead. Buy another one and then drop dead," I said, "because it's too damn big to shoe. It's too damn big to feed, and it's too damn big to clean." A quiet voice came from the horse's head. He said, "Well," he said, "when I bought this horse," he said, "I thought it would be a very useful horse." So I said, "you a Lord Ashton?" So he said, "yeah." I said, "well, I still mean what I say. It's too damn big." I said, "no sense in buying anything like this." So he said, "you know," he said, "there's always two things I wanted to do." He said, "one was to shoe a horse, and one was to lay a hedge." I don't know if you've ever seen the hedges that were laid in. I mean, it's really a beautiful sight to see a hedge laid. Have you ever heard of it?
No.
No, I haven't either.
No.
Oh, they're beautiful. They'll go around a field with this hedge in, and they'll intertwine it, and it never gets about this high,
mm-hmm,
and it's really remarkable to see it. And he said, "those were two things," he said, "I always wanted to do." I said, "well," I said, "you can get my apron on," I said, "and start doing this one now," I said, "because you couldn't go wrong with it. There's plenty of foot." But he didn't take me up on it. Well, when we finished, he thanked me and all this. He said, "well, blacksmith," he said, "we'll go and have a drink now." So we went across in the barn, had a couple of beers. But that's the kind of man he was. Now, you would have taken him for one of the workmen, not the boss, you know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And he used to work on the farm just like the other guy. But yet, as I say, he was the master of the hounds.
Now this is outside. Oh, the wind was strong in the northeast. I didn't think we would get anything at all on the tape. And Faye brings up Missy.
Oh, Faye has had pneumonia.
Oh, yeah.
First time we've ever had anybody sick out here.
I saw one little fall at it very bad. It was on oxygen for a long time. They lost it, of course.
Oh, really?
Mm. Well, one thing, they let the oxygen tank run out and never noticed it.
Now, this is that new rasp, that half rasp.
Canadian Hardware, Ocala, Lumber,
Topolecki. Oh, I was looking, thinking at the horse.
No, they're not an offshoe. This is the offshoe rasp. This one.
Yeah.
See? But when you come to think, which would you rather work with all day? That one or this?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now he shows us how the frog works. I never knew that.
That is the one thing that keeps the foot ill. No.
Missy.
On your markers. Have I got to speak in it?
Two frogs.
There's one going underneath there all the time.
Oh?
When this has done its purpose, it'll shed off. You can just peel it off and there's a new frog underneath it.
but what happens, this gets thinner and thinner as the other one comes up. And then they cut them, they try to cut this old one, and they're cutting into the new one. So they've damaged the new one before they even comes into use.
Oh.
So, we leave it alone, I leave it alone. I got into a lot of trouble when I first came down here for that, but now... Good. A lot of these managers, they had the idea that if you don't cut a frog away and keep it there, that and the other, that they get thrush.
Uh-huh.
They don't get thrush.
Uh-huh.
Dirt never causes thrush.
Oh.
It's inactivity.
It's inactivity.
Yeah. Start telling me to cut a frog off. I say, well, you take your shock absorbers off your car. No. You wouldn't think of it, would you? I said, but yet you want me to take the shock absorbers off this horse? No. You wouldn't think of it, would you? I said, but yet you want me to take the shock absorbers off this horse? Which is exactly the same thing. That takes all the jog. And it also pumps the foot. I don't know whether you've ever seen a foot work. You ever seen one work? Our foot works continuously under when it's walking. He's maybe a little hard because...
Look at this. Look at this.
See?
Uh-huh.
See how it moves in and
uh-huh.
out?
Uh-huh.
Oh!
Well, when that frog presses, it opens that.
Uh-huh.
And pumps the blood. See?
Uh-huh.
And unless a foot will expand and contract all the time, then it's unhealthy. Becomes unhealthy.
Uh-huh. I see.
Somehow you'll get some, maybe. See, she's had this pneumonia. She's certainly had a temperature. Well, the temperature will always go to the feet, harden the feet up. That's one thing you always want to watch when you get off with a temperature. Watch his feet. Especially front ones, back ones don't matter. But fever will always fly to the feet. And that's what causes a lot of this foundering and things like that is. They've got a temporary fever and it lies to the feet.
That's true. I see, I didn't know that.
Run away.
Oregon. And this mare is bred to one of the stallions over at Sunshine Stud. The first, the gray stallion.
Oh,
first
play. All right.
Mm-hmm. Well, you want to see it, Molly? First, if, well, I won't tell you. Back feet. But won't be for you.
Come on, see that.
At Bobby.
Have you ever seen them going in and out?
You know,
Missy, yeah, come down there.
I've never seen the foot actually doing.
See?
Uh-huh.
That's what you call a thumb test. If they don't come up to that, then you want softening up a little.
No, our farrier used to, you'd take a shoe off the horse and he'd show us where the shoe had been worn by the foot moving.
By the friction, yes.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. It'd be, at the toe, it would be sort of grayish, but at the back of the heel, it would be, it's shiny as it can be.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Rasp the horn down to just to where it was pink.
Oh, well, now, don't worry about that pink business. You will get a pink streak in a lot of them.
Yeah. But they'd rasp all the top layer off.
Yeah. On the top, you mean? On here?
Yeah.
Oh. That's the thing you should never do. Like that you didn't file above the nails in England.
Yes, they
would. And in the old carriage days, when they used to have the horses and carriage, which those carriage horses were just as valuable as these race horses, you know, they'd come along and they'd want the shoe, and they'd mark with a chalk mark where they wanted the nails.
Oh.
And you had to put them in.
I said I was curious to me why a horse would be sensitive about one foot and not the other. And he gives this case of the steer or yearling.
I don't know. I'll tell you.
Sensitive to one foot.
I used to go out the yearling down one time from an outside place. I did 3 feet on it, never did a wrong thing. Perfect. I went to ask for the other one, and bang up. She came up with two front feet and just went to our back feet and just smashed my head.
Oh.
Well, the assistant trainer, he should always stop that. So he got the chain, uh-huh. Put it over the top of her leg.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
A twist.
And not a twist, no.
Oh, a chain from the head.
Shank.
Oh. I see, yeah.
And give her one. So perfect. Never did a wrong thing. So the next time, I thought, well, we'll try it without again. No, just the same thing. So I got the shank and she just turned the leg back. Deliberately turned the leg back and put it on there. I didn't pull it or anything. And you know that horse used to open its lip every time I went to do it. And it was only bad on one leg. And I tried it, I did it for about 3 months. I thought, oh, I'd be all right now. Just the same. So we just...
Well, I never heard of anything like that.
I'll tell you, it's a funny thing, you know. Pulled some of these stallions. You know, you do get your outlaw with them. Don't misunderstand me, but... 50% of them are made that way by the people at Hamlet. The same idea as you, that the stallions are only one way... Oh, my goodness gracious! Good luck! You just give me this foot. Get big. Not all horses are good, eh? You've done pretty nice at the track and you've bred some good horses. There used to be a paddock about as big as this. And he'd be on the far side we've got where that palm tree is, and I just go, I shout, come on, good egg. Come up with his ears and he'd come trotting over. Nobody holding him or anything, just from his feet.
Oh?
Yeah. The worst reputation one was a horse called Battlefield. He was all right as far as kicking. He didn't do any kicking, but he would bite. He was a killer for biting.
Yeah.
But all he had to do was get a big stick, just hold it near his nose.
Let him bite?
No, he wouldn't bite the stick, no, but just have that stick there. And we used to pick him up. My son and I, we used to go sometimes to some of these farms for the help, and he'd hold for them. And we go out in the field and pick him up. Take the stick with you, you know, pick him up. But one day we picked him up and I said to the boys, you carry the tools, I'll let him go. So I let him go about, 20 yards inside the field. And the boy shouted to me, he said, look out! So he had turned me back on him. And there he was coming for me. So he opened the gate and I come flying through there. Believe me, he would have had me. I've seen thousands of flies on him. Never even fidgeted. Never even pressure down on you.
Yeah.
Just get hold of your arm.
And look at you.
Yeah.
Mr. Howard, this is Hubert H. Humphrey. This horse.
Yeah?
Hubert. Oh, no, please.
Excuse me, Mr. Howard.
Stay away.
I tell you.
Well, the tradesman, as Mr. Howard called him a little later in his tape in the house, in the kitchen, has to be an entertainer as well. But that northeast wind was too strong for us. We couldn't make a tape. That's 10-2 over on 475, 10-2 over 475, and that was Friday morning, the 24th of October, 69. We had to race one of the nice reports. That's the Long family, as Arthurians. There's several stages in this talk. I don't know whether this reel will be enough for it or not. We'll set in. This is Friday night. Seems a long time since this morning. This is channel 2 over, around almost 500, around 480. This is Sunday morning, the 26th of October, 69. Breakfast, Sunday morning, 26th of October, 69, at breakfast. That little cock out in the front yard must crow, and he's busy getting busy, just going over the place, crowing. Cocks must crow.
It was the only horse we had on the place, and Nick couldn't stand her.
Yeah, and I went, and, well,
because she was
because she was English. And I can remember that the cornet boy up the road had a horse, and we walked down the road one day, and I happened to mention riding English. And he said, if you put an English saddle on a horse, you ruined it. It became a part of the horse and changed its whole character. I don't know. But he had the only horse size. My first and great love among horses.
You know, I believe that's right, Barbara. I believe that's what I believe that's the way Nick feels about it. You put an English saddle and it changed the character of the horse.
Yeah.
I never thought about that.
I know that's the way that Cornet horse felt about it. He would have thought that if you put something, that it somehow changed the whole horse.
Mm-hmm.
Always startled me.
But this was your first love.
Yeah. He was, I wish I could remember the boy's name, but he got this horse, and sometime during the early part of the summer, and I used to go down there. I was pretty lonely then anyway, and I used to spend all my spare time with this horse. I'd go down there and take sugar to it and talk to it and listen, you know, we just walk for hours together. I didn't dare ride it because I was scared to death of what the boy would say. You know, I was only about 8 then. But sometimes I'd take a rope down and make a halter for it and just lead it wherever I went when I thought he wasn't looking. And towards the end of the summer, I began to get real bold. I used to get on the horse. And if it started going very fast, like into a fast walk, I'd jump off real quick because I was afraid I'd get caught. Good deal, I was going to get caught riding that horse. And but you know, he used to walk around the pasture with his chin just resting on my shoulder, and we'd walk around like that. He'd follow me. And sometimes I'd just go over and take a book and sit under the haystack and read, and that horse would stand there and listen to me.
You'd read to the horse?
Yeah. But I think the worst thing I did, you see, I took sugar to him. And one day I went out there and he started, he was in a playful mood. And he almost ran me down. He swerved at the last minute. I also jumped the other direction last minute, so we made to miss each other. But he had me scared for a minute, so I decided I'd leave real quick, like before I got caught. And I was going up the road, and I met the cornet boy just when I got up to the top of the barn. And he said, "You been playing with you a bit?" "Yep. Come on, we'll go ride."
Oh.
And he went back. He went on. I went turned around, went back with him, and Red wouldn't let him catch him. So he started throwing stones. He picked up a handful of stones, and Red go one direction, he'd throw a stone right in front of him. Red go the other direction, and the stone would land right in front of him. Till finally, that poor horse didn't know where to go, and he just stopped. You never hit him with a stone.
I never heard of that.
I know. I never saw it before or since. Always that stone would just go right where enough to stop the horse. And then when he finally was just standing there, a boy walked right up to him, praised him, petted him, brought him back in, put a saddle on him, and let me ride him up and down the lane once or twice in the saddle.
That's the most amazing thing I've heard. I never heard of... If we had known that with Champ, guys...
Yeah.
Well, I've never seen it before since. And what amazed me about it, I was sitting there thinking, oh, how horrible, throwing stones at the poor horse. And then when he went up to it, when the horse finally stood still, and patted it.
Yeah.
And it just sort of startled me because I hadn't been prepared for that. I was prepared for a rough country boy catching his horse a rough way. And I hadn't been prepared for him to go up like that to it.
So could open a sack.
Yeah. That's one of the things that always startled me about my mother. But she'd laugh at me when I couldn't open one. She'd tell me, it's just a crochet stitch. And there I'd be still struggling around. That didn't help me at all.
I never can get those doggone things undone.
They're always fighting me. They're always doing one thing or another. The British make it so simple. They just put a big string and a little string, and you pull the big one, and that's all there is to it. But and they're both the same size. It gets too doggone complicated for my mentality. I don't know what to do with it. I don't know. My mom, I was helping with fertilizing one day, and I couldn't get the doggone thing undone. She came over, and she just laughs at me. She never pays any attention to me. She says, "Oh, it's all right. It's just a crochet knot." Sure. Sure it is. Sure it's just a crochet knot. Big help.
Big help.
Yeah. I think she told me, but I can't remember. I swear I can't remember whether she actually told me what to do with the thing or not.
You were sort of furious.
I don't know whether I was paying any attention. She did. But it's always surprising. I think it's because my father. I've always had the feeling that somehow our family should be all very academic and, I don't know how to put it exactly, but sort of professorial. Is that a good enough word? And about every time I get to thinking we are like that, my mother is off discovering bugs under logs. It sort of blows the whole picture. You lose it. She's always got this going out and looking for things that come up and surprise me. I take my father's character a bit, and then I go to the same one. It startled me when I when I got in high school, I found I enjoyed football. It rather surprised me. And I got home and got talking about it with my mother and found out and was rather startled to learn that my mother had been in the pep band in high school. And she rather enjoyed football games too. So it shook me up a bit.
Cheered you up a bit.
Yeah. What a thing. I think I don't know where these influences come from. I don't think they're... She had that... I don't know. It's just whenever she's out, she's looking at things. And she can project herself so that she can enjoy a moment. And this is one of the things I think she found so exciting about working in the store. I don't think Dad ever caught. But when she was in the store, she worked herself hard, but she was always looking as well. She was always seeing the people that she was working with. And she would come home and she'd talk about these people. I never met most of them. When I did meet them, I never saw them except through my mother's eyes, because I never talked with them. But people like Mr. Overstreet, who was her boss, he was the sort of man who's always running in circles and very nervous and always worrying about something. And he would come out, and the only way she could work through him would be to be able to suggest an idea and let it come back as his idea. Something like a new system. She had worked out a system of, what was it? Of arranging the store. And she managed to put this over in such a way that he was able to come back 2 or 3 weeks later. Come back 2 or 3 weeks later and give this idea as his. He was able to come back and see, it wouldn't hurt his pride that way. Part of the same thing. She she looked at the people around her, you see, and people like well, Mrs. King, who was her assistant manager, or there was one woman, I forget her name, who was on the just one of her one of the salespeople. But she was on Social Security. She could only work so many hours a week. That was all that her husband was in and out of the hospital all the time. But she couldn't earn any more to help him. And the benefits that she was earning weren't enough. And Mom would watch her when she came into the store and would talk with her, and she could just she could put herself in that woman's place, and she would worry. She would take over this woman's worries. She would accept them and see things from her point of view, and worry because the store couldn't pay her anymore, and worry because she couldn't do anything about it. And she'd bring it home with her. She could never leave anything at the store. She'd bring it home and she'd talk to us about it, or she would just simply go up to bed. She'd come home so tired, she'd eat and go to bed, that'd be it. Because she would make herself sick over other people's problems. She would adopt them. Like she did with her.
How do you think Merlin fits into all that?
I don't know. Except that Merlin is, she sees everything as a sort of magic. Everything she sees, she can of magic to. When the spider out here that she was looking at, the one with the crab face, she went to take a picture of.
Get the details.
She went when she was here. She was wandering around with her camera, and she found a spider that she had to. Simply had to have a picture of, because it was something she, it was not only unusual, it was beautiful. She went, I've seen them since. They've got looks like a crab. They look like crabs. Their top is a shell with the points on it. And then they've got little markings on it that make a sort of a face. And when the sun catches them, they're beautiful. But I would never go racing out with a camera to take a picture of that spider. but Mom said, I don't know how long till the light was right.
An hour or so.
Was it about an hour to get to wait for the light to be right?
She sat in the grass and got jiggers. Because she couldn't take that picture until the light.
Till the light was right. And it's the same sort of excitement that goes to Merlin. And Merlin's real for Mom. She just as real as that spider is. Because he, in a sense, represents this sort of excitement. This without Merlin, because Merlin is the magic of Arthur. I think the picture we got of Merlin, or I got of Merlin, perhaps it's more me than my mother, but that I got of Merlin, is from T.H.Y. He's written a book on Arthur, and the first part of it is on Arthur's boyhood. It was written supposedly originally as a separate book. It was supposed to be comic or funny, but it's beautiful because he can
get into it.
He starts with the falconer himself, the man who's in charge of it, is a little wiry man who knows everything about the Falklands. And he takes Arthur out to and teaches him. And there's just so many little things. He's caring for one falcon in particular, a peregrine that they've just brought in, and he hoods it and places it he shows Arthur all the different hoods, how they're made. The one for the peregrine is smaller. And they're made in the castle colors.
Oh.
And the one for the Gerfalcon is plumed, and the one for the each bird is different. And his room is you can almost smell it's all the leather hanging up in various places. And strips of leather on the floor from when he's with scraps of leather, just like a saddler's shop. And the various tools lying around that he works with. And you can just see this mustiness that's high up in the tower. And it's fairly small, you know, but there's all the leather hanging around, and the smell of the leather and of the falcons in the room, and the falconer himself, one of these little men who seems to know everything about his trade.
Like Mr. Howard.
Like Mr. Howard. Yes, very like Mr. Howard.
Tradesman.
Uh-huh. But this is what White does. He creates all these the village life. He goes into in the same detail. And Arthur himself moves through all this until he meets Merlin. And he gets lost in the woods one night. He and Kay are at archery. They go out larking, and it's the falcon. They take the peregrine out to fly her, and something startles her, and she flies into the woods. And Kay gets fed up with it. He doesn't want to bother to go after her, but Arthur says he has to. He must find the peregrine. And he goes into the woods, and as the night goes on, it gets it's darker, and he it's all tangled, and he can't find his way, and he's moving around in the dark trying to follow the falcon from tree to tree until he finally sees the tree where she's staying, and he just decides, well, he'll go to sleep under the tree, and in the morning he'll climb up and get her. So he does. And a couple of other things happen in the meantime, but the next morning she flies off, and he has to follow her again. And she leads him deeper into the woods until all of a sudden he hears a pump. And he follows the sound of the pump, and he walks into a little clearing, and there's the pump, but it's working by itself. There's nobody there. And he stands looking at it. And eventually a little old man with long hair and a cap on backwards and an owl sitting on his shoulder comes bustling out of there's a hut. Comes out of the hut, takes the pail, stops the pump, takes the pail, and says, turns around and looks at him and says something like, "Oh, you've arrived. Come in and have a pot of tea." So he goes into the house. And the house is full of all these little things that you expect. The jam pots will get up and walk. And when they're through the dish, they all run and jump in the sink. But through it all, there's this character, this Merlin. Merlin who makes these things live. And he chatters and talks and can't remember exactly whether he's already met Arthur or whether Arthur is has just arrived, because he lives backwards, you see. He began at the end of time and is living to the beginning of it. And he can't remember whether he's just met Arthur or whether he's already known him.
And your mother loves this.
Well, it's a delightful confusion, and yet he always knows where he's going, really. He knows what he's going to do with Arthur.
Yeah, Donald got into this, too.
Yeah, Donald got into it too. The practical side of it a bit. When he was in England. Because the year he was there, they were doing a lot of digging.
Yeah.
He was spending 2 weeks leave in England, and he was driving down across the South Country.
That was GI leave.
Yeah, yeah. From when he was stationed in France. And he was driving from London. He thought he was going to Minehead. But he stopped in Glastonbury.
What are you going to Minehead for?
I don't know. He didn't know either once he got there. But, no, he was, I think he wanted to visit the Moor Country. I think that was the point of it. Dartmoor. But, He got to Glastonbury and was sort of visiting all the places, and the Glastonbury Tor is one of the places. It's a great big mound with a tower on top. There used to be a chapel to St. Michael.
Oh.
And it stands out. You can see it from Wells, which is way up the way. Beautiful. And of course he went up there, and there was a dig in progress, one of these digs. They were searching for evidence that the Tor might have been used as an outpost, military outpost, in the 6th century. And he got chatting with some of the members of the dig, and one of the people he got chatting with was the man who was in charge of it. And he said...
Now, Don can walk up and...
Yeah,
start calling people.
He can. He has this marvelous ability. He can just walk up and start talking, and pretty soon he can just be on that sort of basis.
I know that experience, right, Donald.
Yeah. He can. I don't know where he gets. I do know where he gets it from too. You know that gun shop in Moorhead? That gun shop on Main Street?
Tell me about it.
Well, it was a little shop on Main Street. You go in and then it was one of these dark little places with guns on either side. And
now that's the end of this reel. That's the end of Channel 2 over. The end of Channel 2 over, and continued on Reel 2. Barbara, Reel 2. That's the end of Channel 2 over. Sunday the 26th of October 69, Sunday the 26th of October 69, the end of Channel 2 over, the end of Reel 1, Barbara Reel 1. Now this will be continued on Reel 2.